And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city. I want to make, before I start the show, I want to make folks aware of some new scams that are going around. This one, which shows a great deal of imagination, comes from the county tax office. Or at least that's what they say they are. You owe back taxes, and if you push one, you can talk to a tax professional. And they, in one case, I'm told, they said you could pay your taxes with Walmart gift cards, which I doubt. Well, today's December the 15th, 349th day of the year. Only 16 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in 533, Vandalic War, Byzantine General Belisarius defeats the Vandals, commanded by King Gelimer at the Battle of Tricamerum. In 687, Pope Sergius I is elected as a compromise between antipopes Pascal and Theodore. That would make you feel good. You're a compromise. 1025, Constantine VIII becomes the sole emperor of the Byzantine Empire, 63 years after he was crowned co-emperor. 1161, Jin-Song Wars. Military officers conspire against the emperor, Wen Yang of the Jin Dynasty, after a military defeat at the Battle of Kaishi. And they assassinate the emperor at his camp. 1167, Sicilian Chancellor Stephen Duperc moves the royal court to Messina to prevent a rebellion. 1256, Mongol forces under Halugu Khan enter and dismantle the Nizari Ismaili stronghold at Alamut Castle. Now, the Nizari Ismaili were the assassins. Alamut Castle was their headquarters, located in present-day Iran. This was part of the Mongol offensive on Islamic Southwest Asia. 1270, the Nizari Ismaili garrison of Gurgul, Persia, surrenders after a siege of 17 years by the Mongols. 1467, Stephen III of Moldavia defeats Matthias Corvinus of Hungary, with the latter being injured three times at the Battle of Baia. 1651, Castle Coronet in Guernsey, the last stronghold that supported the king in the English, the Third English Civil War, actually finally surrenders. 1778, American Revolutionary War, British and French fleets clash at the Battle of St. Lucia. 1791, the U.S. Bill of Rights becomes law and ratified by the Virginia General Assembly. It's been pretty much ignored lately, but it is the law. 1836, U.S. Patent Office building in Washington, D.C. nearly burns to the ground, destroying all 9,957 patents issued by the federal government to that date, as well as 7,000 related patent models. 1864, American Civil War. Battle in Nashville begins at Nashville, Tennessee, and ends with the following day with the destruction of the Confederate Army of the Tennessee as a fighting force by the Union Army of the Cumberland. From what I read, that was the very first time a Confederate force had been absolutely devastated in a battle. I think John Bell Hood was the commander. 1869, short-lived Republic of Izo was proclaimed in the Izo area of Japan. It's the first attempt to establish a democracy in that country. 1890, Papa Lakota leader Sitting Bull is killed on Standing Rock Indian Reservation, leading to the Wounded Knee Massacre. He was actually killed by members of the Apache police force. 1893, Symphony No. 9 from the New World, also known as the New World Symphony, by the Antonin Dvorak, premieres in a public afternoon rehearsal at Carnegie Hall in New York City, followed by a concert premiere on the evening of December 16th. 1899, the British Army forces are defeated at the Battle of Colenso in Natal, South Africa. That's the third and final battle fought during the Black Week of the Second Boer War. 1903, Italian American food cart vendor Italo Marchionne gets a U.S. patent for inventing a machine that makes ice cream cones. And that was quite a scientific advancement, let me tell you. 1905, the Pushkin House is established in St. Petersburg, Russia to preserve the cultural heritage of Alexander Pushkin. 1906, the London Underground's Great Northern, Piccadilly, and Brompton Railway opens up. 1914, World War I, the Serbian Army recaptures Belgrade from the invading Austro-Hungarian Army. Also in 1914, a gas explosion at Mitsubishi Hojo coal mine in Kyushu, Japan, killed 687. 1917, World War I, an armistice between Russia and the Central Powers is signed. That was after the Tsar met his fate. 1939, Gone with the Wind, the highest inflation-adjusted grossing film in history, gets its premiere at Lowell's Grand Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. Margaret Mitchell was the author. 1941, the Holocaust in Ukraine. German troops murder over 15,000 Jews at the Britsky Yar, a ravine southeast of the city of Kharkiv. 1942, World War II. The Battle of Mount Austin, the Galloping Horse and the Seahorse, begins during the Guadalcanal Campaign. 1943, World War II, the Battle of the Arroway begins during the New Britain Campaign. 1944, World War II, a single-engine UC-64A Norseman airplane carrying U.S. Army Air Force Major Glenn Miller is lost in a flight over the English Channel. They have never even found the wreckage to this date. 1945, occupation of Japan, Shinto directive. General Douglas MacArthur orders that Shinto be abolished as a state religion of Japan. 1960, Richard Pavlik is arrested for plotting to assassinate President-elect John Kennedy. Also in 1960, King Mahendra of Nepal suspends the country's constitution, dissolves parliament, dismisses the cabinet, and imposes direct rule. 1961, Adolf Eichmann is sentenced to death after being found guilty by an Israeli court of 15 criminal charges, including charges of crimes against humanity, crimes against the Jewish people, and membership of an outlawed organization. 1965, Project Gemini. Gemini 6A, crewed by Wallace Schirra and Thomas Stafford, is launched from Cape Kennedy, Florida. 4 minutes later, it achieves the first space rendezvous with Gemini 7. 1970, Soviet spacecraft Venera 7 successfully lands on Venus, the first successful soft landing on another planet. 1973, John Paul Getty III, grandson of American billionaire John Paul Getty, is found alive near Naples, Italy, after being kidnapped by an Italian gang on July 10th. 1973, the American Psychiatric Association votes 13-0 to remove homosexuality from its official list of psychiatric disorders. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. 1978, President Jimmy Carter announces the U.S. will recognize the People's Republic of China and several diplomatic relations with the Republic of China, Taiwan. Now, Jimmy Carter did whatever the bankers told him to do. And they had more to gain from China than they did from Taiwan. 1981, a suicide car bombing targeting the Iraqi embassy in Beirut, Lebanon, levels the embassy, kills 61 people, including Iraq's ambassador to Lebanon. That attack is considered the first modern suicide bombing. 1989, second optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights relating to the abolition of capital punishment is adopted. 1993, the Troubles. The Downing Street declarations issued by British Prime Minister John Major and Irish Taoiseach Albert Reynolds. 1997, Tajikistan Airlines Flight 3183 crashes in a desert near Sahara, United Arab Republics. 85 people are killed. A third reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant shut down. 2001, the Leaning Tower of Pisa reopens after 11 years and $27 million spent to stabilize it without fixing its famous lean. 2005, introduction of the Lockheed Martin F-22 Raptor into the United States Air Force active service took place on this date. 2010, a boat carrying 90 asylum seekers crashes into rocks off the coast of Christmas Island in Australia. 48 people die. 2013, the South Sudanese Civil War begins when opposition leader Dr. Riek Machar, Pagan Amum, and Rebecca Nyanding vote to boycott the meeting of the National Liberation Council of at Nyakaran. 2014, gunman Manharon Monis takes 18 hostages inside a cafe in Martin Place for 16 hours in Sydney. Monis and two hostages are killed when police raid the cafe the next morning. 2017, a 6.5 earthquake strikes the Indonesian island of Java in the city of Tasikmalaya, resulting in four deaths. You know, on this date in AD 37, Nero, the Roman Emperor, is born. He died in AD 68. Bit of a lunatic, don't you know? A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. It's Bill of Rights Day in the U.S., South Carolina, it's Second Amendment Day. Christian Feast Day, Drina Martyrs. Drustin in the Aberdeen Breviary, John Horton and Robert MacDonald in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Maria Crucifissa de Rosa Messman, Valerian of Abinda, Virginia Centurion Braselli, Homecoming Day in Alderney, Kingdom Day in the Netherlands. If the 15th is on a Sunday, it's celebrated on the 16th of December. Okay, for some reason, I get calls from all over the world about my car's extended warranty. It makes no sense. And it's Zamenhof Day in the International Esperanto Community. So let's see what else we might have. Lemon 24, Chancellor Hammerich selects Pope. Lamberto becomes Honorius II. 1167, the Sicilian Chancellor, Stephen Duperch, moves the royal court to Messina, as I mentioned earlier. 1488, Bartholomew Dias returns to Portugal after becoming the first known European to sail around the Cape of Good Hope. 1569, honey by Queen Elizabeth I for treason in the Rising of the North. Charles Neville, the Earl of Westmoreland, escapes to Scotland. 1586, Lavinus Torrentius becomes Bishop of Antwerp. 1593, the State of Holland grants a patent on a windmill with a crankshaft. 1612, German astronomer Simon Marius is the first to observe the Andromeda galaxy through a telescope. 1640, Duke of Braganca is crowned King Johann IV of Portugal. 1660, in the Philippines, Andres Malongs rebels and plunders Bagnoten. 1675, King Philip's War. After peace talks fail, Narragansett warriors attack the Jeray Bull Blockhouse in South Kingston, Rhode Island. At least 15 colonists are killed. 1680, there's a tax revolt on Terschelling due to tax on cereal. 1745, the Battle of Kesseldorf. The Prussian forces beat the Saxon and the Austria near Dresden. 1791, the first U.S. law school was established, University of Pennsylvania. 1792, the first life insurance policy is issued in the U.S. It was done in Philadelphia. 1794, the Revolutionary Tribunal is abolished in France. 1810, the first Irish magazine in the U.S. called Shamrock is published. 1840, Napoleon Bonaparte gets a French state funeral in Paris 19 years after he's murdered. He was poisoned, by the way. 1854, the first street cleaning machine in the U.S. is used in Philadelphia. 1863, Romania's mountain railway from Anina to Orăvița opens up. 1874, the first reigning king to visit the U.S. is the King of Hawaii. Received by President Grant. Eventually, we took his country away from him. 40 years ago, identified as, members of a band. I get these messages and then they go away. All righty, I can't find it, it's gone. In 1902, German agricultural tariffs are increased. 1907, in Persia, the Shah leads a coup d'etat against the liberal prime minister Nasir al-Muluk and imprisons him, but a popular uprising forces the Shah to put him back in power shortly after that. 1913, Nicaragua becomes a signatory to the Buenos Aires Copyright Treaty. 1914, Battle of Lodz ends. The Russians retreat toward Moscow. 1914, the British fleet forfeits a chance to destroy the German fleet in the North Sea. Also in 1914, the Serbian troops retake Belgrade in Austria-Hungary. 1916, Battle of Verdun. French launch a major offensive against the German lines after a six-day artillery bombardment. 1917, the Moldavian Republic declares independence from Russia. 1918, the American Jewish Congress holds its first meeting. 1919, Fiume Rijeka, which is modern Croatia, declares its independence. 1926, the fascist national symbol is elevated in Italy. 1927, William Edward Hickman kidnaps 12-year-old Marion Parker in L.A., whom he later kills. 1929, Swiss pilot Walter Mittelholzer is the first to fly over Mount Kilimanjaro. 1934, the Fokker F-18 Snip flies to the Dutch West Indies. 1939 was the first commercial manufacture of nylon yarn in Seaford, Delaware. 1939, the Dutch airplane, the Snip, which is a Fokker FXV-3, departs for its first flight to Paramaribo in Caraco. 1941, gas and electrical use restricted in Holland. 1941, the USS Swordfish becomes the first U.S. sub to actually sink a Japanese ship. And on that note, we're going to go back to talking about strange things. And there's certainly a lot of them. You know, we're going to start out talking about a rare phenomenon. And it's still unexplainable. But there are people who seem to be charged with high voltage electricity. Medical science doesn't know what to make about them, so it does the next best thing. It ignores. Now, the first case we're going to talk about. Dr. Ashcraft doubted the stories he'd been hearing about this young girl's charge of high voltage electricity, so he reached out and took her hand. A few minutes later, when he opened his eyes, the doubting doctor found himself on his back, surrounded by a group of worried friends. The young girl's name was Jenny Moran, had put another person down. She lived near Sedalia, Missouri in 1895. At the time, she was a frail, nervous girl in her mid-teens. The phenomena which attracted so much attention to her wasn't noticeably present until she was about 14. Then, for no apparent reason, she suddenly behaved like a powerful storage battery. When she reached for the pump handle, sparks flew from her fingers. The voltage was so high that the spark was painful to her. And it would doubly painful to anybody who chanced to touch her under conditions enabled the electricity to leap through their bodies. Needless to say, this young lady had few close friends. She regarded the phenomenon as a curse, principally because the family cat was one of her favorite pets, and the cat avoided her like the plague after it got a few shocks from her. By the time she reached maturity, the strange electrical endowment had faded, and she became another normal young woman, much to her delight and to the delight of the family cat. You know, medical and newspaper records tell of another human storage battery in the person of Carolyn Clare of Bondon, Ontario. In 1877, when she was 17, she was a 130-pounder, lived with her parents and six brothers and sisters. She became ill, lost her appetite, began to fade away. Doctors could find nothing wrong with her, but she continued to dwindle until her weight dropped to slightly less than 90 pounds. And then she underwent a mental change as drastic and as baffling as the physical change. She began to suffer from seizures, or as the doctors called them, convulsions. While in this state, her body was rigid, eyes fixed and staring. She would mumble at great length of faraway places and scenes that she had never visited. It made no sense to those that knew her, because this simple child had hardly been outside her native town. Well, for a year and a half, she remained in this condition until she took a turn for the better. But it was not an unmixed blessing, because when her physical and mental health returned to normal, she discovered she had acquired an unwanted propensity for shocking people who merely touched her. Oddly enough, she not only admitted considerable voltage seemed to be magnetized as well, because when she picked up any medical article susceptible to magnetic attraction, she couldn't let go of it. Somebody had to forcibly pull that article from her open hand. Well, as in the case of Jenny Moran, the curse of the annoying electrical charge left Carol when she reached maturity. It simply faded gradually and didn't return. The case was studied by physicians. A report was made to the Ontario Medical Association in the summer of 1879. In 1890, 16-year-old Louis Hamburger came to the Maryland College of Pharmacy, where his unusual ability to act as a human magnet soon attracted the attention of the faculty. These particular gentlemen felt the need for more highly trained investigators, so they invited various medical and electrical experts to come view this remarkable young man. Their report indicated they were quite baffled by Louis Hamburger's ability to make heavy iron or steel objects dangle from his fingertips as though from a powerful magnet. Metal rods half an inch in diameter and a foot long were no problem at all. When iron filings were placed in a glass beaker, he could lift the beaker with the tips of three fingers pressed against the glass. And when one of the fingertips was pulled away, it caused an audible click. Well, they never did determine the cause of all this. And the electrical phenomenon that jinxed Jenny Moran and Carolyn Clare and Louis Hamburger was similar in a general way to that that plagued Frank McKinstry of Joplin, Missouri in 1889. Similar to the extent that, like the others, the phenomena was not subject to his will and the voltage was at its peak in the morning after he'd had a good night's rest. Then throughout the day it slowly faded away. On cold days, especially, those people are subject to accumulations of static electricity. He had the unfortunate faculty of becoming so heavily charged that walking actually became a task, as though he was treading on flypaper. And he was investigated and then forgotten, because in all these cases, science admittedly found only the evidence. They did not find the answers. And when ivory tower scientists can't find the answers, they conveniently forget about the problem. Well, what would you do about a phantom sniper? Well, it happened in what was called Britain's Mystery Mile. Motorist after motorist skidded to a stop after their windshields were shattered by this phantom sniper. There were bullet holes, but there was the mystery as well, which still remains a mystery. According to police records, the first motorist whose windshield was shattered on that same stretch of road reported this unnerving experience in March of 1951. The first of 32 such reports the word police received in the ensuing 16 months. The experience of Thomas Woods of York Road in Kingston, Surrey is typical of these cases. April 3rd, 1952, a bit after 4:30 in the afternoon, he was driving his truck between Cobham and Esher on the road from London to Portsmouth. Traffic was almost non-existent. The only other vehicle in sight was another truck about 100 yards in front of him. Suddenly his windshield shattered. Glass flew back on the front seat. And there, perhaps a foot to the left of his head, was a hole through the glass large enough for him to stick his fist through. He noted the spot where this happened and headed for the nearest police station to report. He later was quoted as saying, "I find this to be quite unsettling." Truck driver Thomas Woods was expressing the feeling of scores of motorists who had shared his experience, both before and after. Strangely, the phantom bullets always find their mark in one straight stretch of road about 2.5 miles long. It's smooth. There's no speed limit. The fields along the highway are open, with the exception of a few small bushes where no gunman could certainly hide. But time after time, there's a flash, a crash, and the windshields are perforated with holes similar to those that might be made by a very small, high-powered rifle. As the reports came in, time after time, the perplexed police felt encouraged. Take the case to Mrs. Eric Sykes, May 8, 1952. They were driving along at a modest 40 miles an hour near Esher Common when there was a bright flash as though a firecracker had exploded on their windshield. A bang like a gunshot, and their windshield was cobwebbed with hairline cracks radiating from a hole about the diameter of a lead pencil. Eric slid to a stop. He and his wife jumped out and looked around for their assailant and saw nothing except the open rolling fields. There wasn't a car in sight. Well, after about a year of these experiences, the police theorized some gun crank with a high-powered rifle was haunting the roadside along that stretch of highway, firing through motorist's windshield. That was a dangerous prank, which they knew was inevitably going to end in tragedy. Well, this was a good theory, but that's all it was. The objects that cracked the windshield came from many angles, and they vanished when they struck the windshield. They were never found inside the cars, nor did they ever go through the cars. Gun experts admitted that under test conditions, it might be possible to create such an effect by using frangible bullets that would disintegrate on impact, but only at very short distances and certainly not on a moving target carrying passengers down a public highway. But even that theory fell by the wayside when microscopic examination of the bullet holes, including one in the metal door of a car, failed to produce any evidence frangible bullets had been used. Well, while the worried police were setting traps and studying reports of the phantom bullets of the Portland Road, the phenomena changed its locale. Moved right into the town of Esher itself. June 16, 1952, a shop window in Station Road was neatly holed, and 4 days later, angry tavern keeper reported to police he too had been a victim. There was a small round hole in the front window of his tavern, identical to those in the motorist windshields. Whoever or whatever was responsible for the phantom bullet holes was internationally inclined, it would seem. In June of 1952, state police of both Indiana and Illinois found themselves chasing a phantom gunman who was fully as elusive as the one in England. American motorists, like their British counterparts, saw nothing, heard nothing except a flash on the windshield, the bang, and the splintered glass that showered inside the car. And once again, no bullet was ever found inside the car, no hole where it might have gone through the vehicle. Science, of course, was baffled, but not without a suggestion. It is known that a meteorite the size of a pinhead traveling at an incredible speed could produce precisely the effects attributed to phantom bullets. And science said, yes, it's possible, but not under known circumstances. Well, so another theory was filed away. Only the shattered windshields and the riddle remained. They never did find the cause of it. Well, let's talk about the enigma of Deaton Rock. For almost 300 years, the story carved into the face of Deaton Rock has defied the best efforts of scholars. If the latest attempt to decipher it proves to be the correct one, history will have to add a new and fascinating chapter. The writing on Deaton Rock has been there for centuries. There's no mistake about that. Someone spent many months with a metal tool of some unknown type hammering the message, whatever it might be, into the hard stone surface that shows above tidewater at the junction of the Taunton River at Assanet Neck in Massachusetts. Best seen when the sunlight glances obliquely across its face, the writing on the rock has been a subject of controversy and wonder since about 1690. And that year, the redoubtable Cotton Mather, he who made it his job to track down witches, well, he wrote, among the curiosities in New England is out of a mighty rock covered in part at high tide. On the perpendicular side thereof, there's a deeply engraved, no man alive knows how or when, about a half score of lines. They're about 10 feet long and a foot and a half broad, filled with strange characters which suggest as odd thoughts about them that there were here before us. Is there odd shapes in that elaborate monument? Well, from Cotton Mather's data, our own speculation as to the origin and purpose of the carvings has been rife and richly endowed with imaginative proposals. Well, first to go on record with a possible solution to the mystery of the writing on Deaton Rock was Count de Gobelin of Paris, who came and marveled and went away to ponder. He later declared he had fathomed the meaning of the rock writing. Sailors from ancient Carthage, he said, who lived among the Indians on the Massachusetts shore for a time, were writing about how they consulted an oracle for advice on when to leave for Carthage. Interesting supposition, but didn't have any scientific support. 1807, Samuel Harris Jr. of Harvard delivered a different interpretation of that same writing. He said it was unmistakably ancient Hebrew. He professed to see Phoenician letters indicating priest, king, and idol. Well, for the next 24 years, the puzzle rested at that point until Ira Hill, a Maryland school teacher, was intrigued by the strange carvings, divested himself of still another explanation. He called attention to a passage in the Old Testament. It discussed how Hiram and Solomon sent out an expedition to bring gold from Ophir. According to Mr. Hill, the carvings of Deaton Rock tell the story of this biblical expedition, which started in Ophir and somehow got to Massachusetts instead. Fortunately for later scholars, a minister made a careful sketch of the carvings in 1690, and this sketch enables students of the present to fill in where vandals and the ravages of wind and wave have made erasures in the intervening centuries. All agree the marks are deliberate carvings of considerable age, painstakingly and laboriously done for a purpose presently unknown. In view of the physical requirements for carving such hard stones, there's little likelihood they could be of Indian origin. It's also worth noting the carvings are engraved on the side of the rock facing the sea. Would they be readily seen by any vessel that ventured into the anchorage in search of shelter or perhaps drinking water? In 1837, a Danish scholar named Carl Ruffin published a study of the enigma, a document in which he sought to link the writings with a recorded trip of Leif the Lucky, who sailed in the year 1000 to the shores of the North American continent. According to Ruffin, on Deaton Rock, he and his colleagues had traced out the Norse characters which described a conquest by Thorfinn, leader of the Viking colonists, who, with 151 companions, fought off the Indians. Well, this interpretation requires a bit of imagination and patience, since the Roman numerals on the stone read 131, which Ruffin declared meant 151 in runic symbols. Well, the Deaton carvings have been stretched to cover so many different interpretations that it would be more fitting than had they been engraved on rubber. From the biblical version to the North interpretation was quite a spread, equaled only by a remarkable performance from the Algonquin Indian sage Chingwok, when he was asked by historian Henry Schoolcraft to interpret the Deaton carvings. Chingwok came up with a lengthy report alleging the carvings described a great battle between two Indian nations, a conclusion even more fanciful than its predecessors. The latest entry on the Deaton Rock Derby is a study made by Professor Delaberry of Brown University. After systematically demolishing the other interpretations, he said the carving tells the story of Miguel Cortereal by the will of God, the leader of Indians. Well, he could well be right, because Miguel Cortereal reached Newfoundland in 1502, 9 years before the date of the Deaton carvings. He never went back to Portugal. The laborious carvings on the rock may tell his story after four centuries to those who can decipher it. As Professor Delaberry admitted, there's much that's debatable in the carvings of Deaton Rock. It just depends on how you look at it. And certainly that could well be the case. Well, I mentioned earlier, when I was doing our little history segment, that France gave Napoleon a state funeral 19 years after his death. Now, modern medical science is still seeking clues to a puzzle that's baffled historians for more than a century. The riddle regarding Napoleon's death. In the village of Bellecourt on the Moose River in France, a faded page of the town records may hold part of the key to the strange death of Napoleon Bonaparte. On that page is described the name of Francis Eugene Robald, born in this village 1771, died on St. Helena. The date of his alleged death on that sandy, sun-baked island is illegible, obliterated long ago, and maybe with good reason. Because in view of the existing evidence, it's not improbable that he died on St. Helena, May 5, 1821, under the name of Napoleon Bonaparte, a man he closely resembled. Now, Bonaparte took great pains to secure doubles for himself. He had four in all, and one of them of that number was Francois Robault. One double died of poison just prior to Waterloo. Another was crippled by a riding accident, Another was killed by a stray bullet. And only Ribault was left when Napoleon's fortunes collapsed. He went back to live with his homely spinster sister in her cottage at Bellecourt. Now, Napoleon, of course, was banished to St. Helena off the coast of Africa. The British and the French agreed he must not escape again as he had done from Elba. The French guarded him on the island itself, while the British furnished the vessels to patrol the waters around the island. Now, Napoleon had a lot of friends. He also had a lot of money. And he had a lot of patience. Working together quietly, they could continue the forces that would free him. In 1818, French General Gourgaud resigned his post of command of St. Helena, was replaced by General Bertrand. Gourgaud returned to Paris, presumably to retire. 2 months after he reached Paris, a fine coach arrived at Bellecourt. The coachman inquired the way to the home of François Ribault. Who was in the coach? And why were they seeking Napoleon's double was never explained. Ribault and his sister went on about their customary routines for another month. And when asked about the coach, they responded it was just a physician who wanted to buy some rabbits for a friend. Nothing really important. Well, one autumn night in 1818, both Ribault and his sister vanished, never to be seen again in Bellecourt. Sister was later found living very comfortably in Tours, where she claimed a physician was paying her bills. A purely platonic arrangement handled entirely by mail. In fact, it was handled by courier. And her brother? Well, Francois had gone away to sea, but had failed to tell her where or when or how. He was a very close-mouthed fellow, by all reports. To escape from St. Helena, Napoleon needed four things. A double, a ship, some friends, money. Well, he had all four. In the winter of 1818, about a month after Ribault's disappearance, General Bertrand's wife wrote to a friend, "Success is ours. Napoleon has left the island." In those same closing days of 1818, a well-dressed stranger who called himself Rivard came to the city of Verona, Italy. A merchant from the north of France, according to what he said, he was a widower who wanted to open a small business. In his case, out of an optician who dealt in diamonds. He acquired a partner, Mr. Petrucci, actually ran the business, jokingly referred to Rivard as the emperor because of Rivard's remarkable resemblance to Napoleon. According to subsequent sworn testimony of Petrucci and others, Rivard received a courier on the afternoon of August 23, 1823. After reading the sealed message that was given to him, he was greatly disturbed. He told Petrucci he had to leave on a most important mission, and 2 hours later, as he got into the coach, he gave Petrucci a sealed letter with instructions delivered to the King of France if Rivard failed to return within 3 months. 12 nights later, shortly after 11 o'clock on September 4th, 1823, lights were blazing brightly at Schönbrunn Castle in Austria. That's where the son of Napoleon was critically ill with scarlet fever. One of the guards heard a rustling in the vines, saw a shadowy figure drop to earth, and ran toward the castle. The guard fired. The intruder fell, dying, shot through the abdomen. The captain of the guards took one look at the body and called the colonel. Eventually, the French embassy took charge, until Napoleon's wife demanded that stranger be buried in her own family plot, which was done. Rivard never came back to Verona. Petrucci delivered the sealed letter to the King of France, was paid handsomely for his service and his silence, I might add. On Helena, death came at last to the prisoner known as Napoleon, a man who didn't write like Napoleon, didn't talk like Napoleon, didn't walk like Napoleon. And he eventually died of poison, though it was said in 1821 he died of cancer of the stomach. But in 1956, the British government revealed they have in their possession a section of Napoleon's intestines. And the specimen shows clearly the owner had died not of cancer, as the man on St. Helena, but from a bullet wound, just like the stranger in the garden of Schönbrunn Castle. You know, there are many mysteries of which we absolutely have no explanation. And one of them is John Keeley's mystery motor. That powerful engine shook the building, but it shook the existing understanding of energy even harder. 23 men were crowded into the same small room that housed that controversial motor. Many of them were engineers, others were professional men or bankers, and all of them were investors. But they had something else in common as well. They were skeptics, and they'd waited years for John Keeley to make good on his claims. Time after time, they poured their money into his endless research and profitless development of the engine that now stood in front of him. And today, he had promised them he'd show them what it could do. Today, they would find out, was he a fraud or a genius? He never even glanced at the hard faces of the men who were packed into the room with him and his engine. If he was aware of their presence, he didn't give any hint. He just apparently ignored the earth-shattering noise that was rattling the small window panes. And the heavy steel machine bolted to the massive stone base came the screech of metal and travail. A deep hum changed to a moan, the moan to a whine. Wilder danced the window frames as though they were eager to flee this unearthly den. Keeley knew he was master of the situation because he and he alone was master of the machine. Those irate investors are demanding proof their money had gone into something practical, and they would have their proof. He lightly tapped a button, and the roar jarred the bones of every man present. When the faint blue fog cleared away, the committee members could see the 1-inch lead ball that had been expelled from the machine at such incredible force that it shot completely through two heavy oak planks and buried itself in a sandbox against the wall. Well, the committee admitted that was quite impressive, but when could they expect to see this latent power put to work in a fashion that would reimburse the stockholders? Well, for John Keeley, this session with the Stockholders Committee in November of 1879 was an old, old story. He gave them performance and insisted on profits. Over and over again, as the stockholders came and went, he endured their criticism and calumny. Through the years of ambivalence that surged about him, Keeley never lost his temper. Neither did he lose his ability to find new financial backers to replace those who gave up and left. For a mechanical inventive genius, John had an unusual background. Born in Philadelphia in 1827, he worked as a carpenter, a violinist, a magician who specialized in card tricks. And finally, he trudged to the Rocky Mountains as a trapper. Eventually wounded by an Indian arrow, he made his way back to Philadelphia and eventually recovered from the wound. This was an age when the need for controllable power was great. Water power couldn't meet the demands of growing industry. Steam power wasn't the answer. There had to be some new cheap source of energy that could be harnessed to turn the wheels in the mills and factories. John Keeley first attracted attention by announcing in 1871 he had tapped a great new source of energy. As he put it with exasperating vagueness, a device which disintegrates the etheric force that controls the atomic constitution of matter. Some scientists challenged him, some ignored him, all were skeptical. He claimed his engine operated on harmonic vibrations. His detractors promptly retorted that the motivating force seemed to be hot air generated by Mr. Keeley himself. Whatever it was, it had enough power to bend steel rails, to tear giant hawsers into shreds, a force beyond anything in common use at the time. In December of 1882, the angry investors demanded a showdown, and they got it. Keeley agreed to reveal the secret of his mystery motor to any scientist the committee named. They selected Edward Bacall, who saw and was convinced. He reported to the unhappy investors, while he didn't understand all he'd seen, he understood enough to know that Keeley had discovered all he claimed. Well, Keeley's rock ran out in 1888, and the stockholders had him sent to jail for ignoring a court order to reveal his secret. Wealthy widow financed him for the next 10 years to the end of his life in 1898. Stockholders wrecked his shop, finally came up on a huge steel ball that contained compressed air. Nothing new about that, because Keeley had often shown the spirit interest in parties and its pipes were inadequate to have operated at the pressures indicated by the performance of the machine. The secret of his mystery motor died with him. Unfortunately, scientists could never agree on how it had operated. The witnesses agreed on only one thing. The engine made a humming sound. The question remains, were they hearing the birth pangs of a great discovery or the persuasive hum of a humbug? They never had a definitive answer. Well, let's talk about something that I'm sure everyone has heard about. Oak Island. You know, electronic instruments tell us there are tons of gold there. It's yours for the taking. But getting it may be take a bit of doing. And if it's gold you want, real gold that is yours for the taking, Oak Island may be the end of the rainbow. Like the proverbial pot of gold at the rainbow's end, you may find it a bit elusive, because on Oak Island, it's there. There's no mistake about that. Lucky ones have touched some of it. The better-equipped seekers have watched the indicator needles on the electronic gear flutter to match their own hearts. But one and all have had to admit defeat. Because the treasured Oak Island is so cunningly concealed, it's defied the best efforts of all comers for over 150 years. Now, Oak Island is a tiny, excuse me, rock atoll that sticks up from the blue waters of Mahone Bay in southern Nova Scotia. Nobody paid much attention to this insignificant speck of land until 1795. On a bright Sunday morning in April of that year, three young men rode out to the island and spent the rest of their lives wishing they hadn't. Tony Vaughn, Danny McGinnis, and Jack Smith. New Oak Island had been used as a haven of refuge and repair by the freebooters who invested the seas in those days. The pirates would anchor in one of the convenient deep coves on the north end of Oak Island, post a lookout in one of several tall trees, and go about their business of removing the barnacles from the ship's bottoms in comparative safety. Edward Teach came there, according to local gossip, and so did Morgan and Steve Bonney and other notorious scum of the sea. They came there and traded with the canny Nova Scotians, paid handsomely to the local authorities who looked the other way while the pilots camped out on Oak Island. One by one, the pirates had been hung or driven from the seas, and when Smith, Vaughn, and McGinnis rode out to the island in 1795, they knew that no pirates had been there, openly or otherwise, for almost 10 years. They also knew that the roistering freebooters had left a lot of evidence of their visits. Pistols, knives, and sometimes a gold coin or two could be found in the sand of the little beach where they gambled and fought and drank. It was Tony Vaughn who called the attention of his companions to the worn place on the limb of that huge oak tree and to the depression in the dirt directly beneath that same limb. They all agreed it looked very much like heavy ropes had been looped over that limb to lower something into a hole that had been later carefully filled in. Working quietly in their spare time for several years, the boys dug down 35 feet. Then in 1803, Smith told Dr. John Lenz of their strange find under the thick layers of coconut fiber they discovered at the 35-foot level. It was a fateful day for Dr. Lenz when he first stood there beside the pit, because in the ensuing years he spent his entire fortune probing its depths for the treasure he was so confident it contained. Workmen paid by the doctor pulled out its excessive 10-foot levels, layers of heavy oak plank, a layer of ship's putty, more thick, tough layers of coconut fiber, presumably hauled there by pirates who had loaded it in the West Indies 2,000 miles away. Beneath the layer of oak plank at the 80-foot level, the workmen found a flat stone inscribed with unintelligible hieroglyphics. Well, as a last resort, with his funds virtually gone, Dr. Lenz brought in a large hand-powered drill. With it, he probed a depth of 100 feet from beneath the surface. The drill cut its way through brittle plaster, more hardwood, and seemed to drop into some sort of subterranean room. The next effort with the drill, racing against the water, was rising rapidly in the pit, brought up a few scraps of gold and a bit of paper. And disaster. Water broke into the pit in such a rush, three workmen drowned. And that was the end of Dr. Lenz's funds. He was bankrupt. But if he had established nothing else, he'd given his fortune in 9 years of his life to show that there was gold of some sort of a man-made vault about 100 feet below the scarred old oak tree. Well, it was another 46 years before Dr. Lenz was able to try again. In the gold rush madness of 1849, old and roomy-eyed, he gathered about him a small group of financial backers. Their workmen reopened the crumbled pit, sank it 10 feet deeper than ever before till they came to a layer of cement. Then their drill broke into that room again, brought up a bit of gold chain, and again, just as success seemed inevitable, the water came pouring in and ruined them. Other treasure seekers, including Franklin D. Roosevelt, spent lavishly of their time and money, trying to solve the mystery of the money pit. They've confirmed the gold is there, and it's cunningly protected by seawater brought in through ingenious tunnels. And if the gold is likely to stay there, because in 1957 the engineers found it as real and as unattainable as ever. And there was even a TV show about it. Well, they spent a lot of time and money trying to get to the gold and never did. Well, ask yourself this. Did the Vikings penetrate to Minnesota? Did they leave a graven record of their trip and its tragic finale? Did they leave that graven record in stone? Historians are aware Vikings reached the shores of the New World century before Columbus. And there's ample evidence they settled briefly as far south as Massachusetts. But did they also penetrate the St. Lawrence River and eventually enter the Great Lakes? A farmer near Kensington, Minnesota, Olaf Allman, and his small son Edward dug up a slab of soft calcite on Allman's farm in 1898 and were surprised, so they said, to discover it was covered with some sort of inscription. For some time, that stone remained a little more than a local curiosity. A few of the better educated members of that predominantly Scandinavian community noted the writing on the stone appeared to be similar to the old rune writing of their ancestors. Mr. Allman sent the stone to Professor George Orme of Northwestern University, who examined it at length and informed the owner it was spurious, a deliberate attempt of some unknown party to falsify history. Well, Mr. Allman, a practical man, put the stone to use as a doorstep for a feed bin. Well, scholars are generally agreed the inscription reads 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on an exploring journey from Vinland very far west. We had camped by 2 skerries, one day's journey north from the stone. We were fishing one day when we returned home and found 10 men red with blood and dead. Ave Virgin Mary, save us from this evil. We have 10 men by sea to look after our vessels. 14 days journey from this island, the year 1362. The stone was bought by Almar Highland of Ephraim, Wisconsin, who then embarked on a career of lecturing and writing on the subject, and his works converted a former skeptic, Professor Sigurdus Nordhall at the University of Iceland, to the belief that the story told on the stone is genuine. Many of the authorities on the subject are convinced the carving on the soft calcite is a recent vintage, probably the work of 2 neighbors of Olaf Allman, men who are known to have produced similar writings as practical jokes. Well, the weakness in the carvings on the Kensington stone lies in the use of runic characters and expressions that were not part of the language used by 14th century Vikings. Holland based his case largely on the record of a Viking expedition left Norway in 1348 and didn't return until 1364. Plus, the story of a small vessel that crept into the harbor of Streymfjord, Iceland in 1347. If Holland's correct and the Kensington stone is indeed a record of Vikings in Minnesota in 1362, history would need to be rewritten extensively. Well, at that note, we've run out of time for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, we'll be talking about things that are stranger than science. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.